You're listening to A Climate Change. This is Matt Mattern, and I've got a great guest on the program today, Jared Lipworth. Jared's the head of Tangled Bank Studios, whose mission it is to emphasize the power of storytelling to inspire interest in science and nature. Jared used to be the vice president at National Geographic Studios, where he produced films for National Geographic Channel, Nat Geo Wild, PBS, and Nova. One of them being Jane, a documentary about Jane Goodall, which is pretty amazing. And before that, Jared was at WNET in New York City and produced a lot of great programming there. Jared, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit. I always like to get the background of what brought you to this space, in particular, the environmental storytelling.
Well, I think I can kind of blame two things for this. It's one was as a kid, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. I used to watch that religiously, and National Geographic World magazine, which was a kid's magazine back when I was a kid. So between those two, I think those solidified my interest in nature and science. I'm originally from South Africa and have been lucky enough to spend a good amount of time out in the wild in various game parks in Africa and also just out in the wilderness here in the U.S. And I think that combination led me to always want to be doing something around science, something around nature, and have managed to steer my career in that direction for most of it.
Well, it's fascinating that you start off with the Mutual of Omaha. Certainly, I remember that as a kid. And I had the pleasure of interviewing one of the new hosts, Dr. Ray Wynn, who was amazing. And, it was a blast from the past. I didn't even know the show was going until we, did the interview. It was amazing. So I am also curious as to, did they play the Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom in South Africa?
Well, I moved when I was young. We moved to New York when I was five. So it wasn't as much as it growing up there as going back a lot to visit family and, spending whenever I had an opportunity to travel. I quite often went to Africa and have spent some time in other countries as well. So, there's just, the wilderness there kind of touches you. It gets under your skin. And once you've seen it, you want to get back as much as possible.
Well, that is it's great that you've aligned your professional life with what you care about and passionate about. So then, where did that take you? As a kid, you had the interest, and then where did you go from there?
I've always the interest in science. I was always interested in it as a as a member of the general public. I was never I never really thought I would pursue a career in science. But I love the scientific approach to understanding the world. Got into journalism, actually got my master's in broadcast journalism. At that point, I really knew that I wanted to be focusing on science and on natural history. But I really fell in love with it at WNET. That's where I started. That was my first job in television. And got to quickly understand the power of storytelling there. We ran a series called Secrets of the Dead, which was using forensic archaeology to explore mysteries of the past. And I had never been much of a history buff, as a student, but when you start to dig into these really intimate stories that tell you about a time, tell you about a place, it kind of changes the way you think about history. So for me, I fell in love with that series. I fell in love with those stories and realized that if you tell a good story, you can actually get a lot of information in there for people. And so the medium kind of grew on me from WNET. And then when I moved to National Geographic, that was more of a shift specifically into, more science oriented and nature and conservation oriented programming.
So how do you see that kind of dovetailing with the movement to educate people about climate change and how our planet is changing?
Yeah, I think it's integral. I think the need for good storytelling is so key, particularly when it comes to conservation, when it comes to climate change. There's so much doom and gloom out there, and rightfully so. It's a pretty scary world we live in. But I also think it's really important to give people hope and to show people that actually there are things that can be done. There are people who are doing them. There are stories of success out there, because I think that's the motivator to get people to make change in their own lives, in their own worlds. So for us, we tend to, at Tangle Bank, we tend to take a very positive approach. We look for the stories that are going to inspire people, that are going to give people that hope. And we try to find the intimate ways to tell those stories. So one of the differentiators, we have a series out right now called Wild Hope, which is stories of conservation successes from around the world. When we were setting out to develop that series, we actually made a pretty significant distinction in the kinds of stories we were going to tell, in that we set this up as a biodiversity series, not a climate change series. Now, it's not to say that climate change isn't a big part of many of these stories, but the way we were looking at it is that, you know, climate change is global. Therefore, solutions, for the most part, need to be global. Biodiversity loss tends to be local, driven by lots of different things, including climate change. But because the biodiversity loss happens locally, you can also see local solutions working. And so that was the approach we took to this series, Wild Hope. And what that then allowed us to do is to go all over the world, but in each place, tell a story about work that fits the place and the problem where they are, as an example of what people can do and what people are doing. So, it comes down to characters. It comes down to people that you can recognize as not all that dissimilar from yourself who are making a difference.
Well, I think as you're talking, I'm thinking about how the unifying power of, you know, National Geographic and that type of platform, and that basically I've never met anybody who said, oh, I hate it, National Geographic channel or whatever. I mean, it's like everybody kind of loves it, and you know, some maybe a bit more than others, but it doesn't divide people. It's very unifying, and I think that's a beautiful kind of way to bring people together, is say, hey, we all love these stories. We all love these animals. This is something that we can all get behind.
Yeah, I think so. Although I would, you know, I would say, I always joke that if I feel like I've made the perfect show if I can reach the EMS audience and the Cabela's audience. You know, so I do think there are some differentiators. I think everybody, that there's huge numbers of people who love the environment, love the planet, love nature, but come at it from different ways. So, you know, I think that's important too, to not only be singing to the choir. You know, we want to actually expand who we're reaching, find stories that are going to appeal to people who we may not think of as necessarily the kinds of conservationists that we generally see. A couple of examples of that from Wild Hope. We had an episode in the first season called Woodpecker Wars that told the story of how a U.S. military base in North Carolina was actually taking better care of a very rare woodpecker species than the biologists who were trying to save it. And they started out at odds with each other, and eventually actually came together because they recognized that what the military was doing by chance on their live firing range was actually creating the perfect habitat for these woodpeckers. And then you had local farmers in the area who, in earlier days, had been cutting down trees because they were afraid they would find this protected woodpecker and then have to do certain things on their land. We're now starting to embrace the woodpecker and realizing that actually it's benefiting them and the woodpecker to protect those forests and those lands. So I think we look for unexpected alliances, I would say, is one of the kinds of stories we look at. We've got another one coming out later on this year about hunters who are working to change the ammunition that hunters are using from lead bullets to copper bullets, because the lead bullets are actually poisoning the raptors and the eagles and some of the other predatory birds that eat on the remains of animals that the hunters have shot. So that film starts out with hunters. It's about hunters, but it's also a conservation success story. So, you know, we want to try to make sure that we're not taking too narrow a focus on who our audience is and what, you know, what kind of stories we think will appeal to them.
Well, I think that's brilliant. And I you know, we could all do more of that to draw in a larger audience, because everybody is affected by this. And to the extent that we kind of maybe take this holier than thou approach, it doesn't draw people in. And so I applaud you for trying to expand the scope of the playing field so that every, you know, because I think that generally speaking, things like National Geographic type stories do cut across pretty much all boundaries, and nobody kind of sees them as political, or at least nobody I've heard of.
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, at Tangled Bank, the other thing we try to do is make sure that our stories are based in really strong science as well. So a lot of research being done to make sure that, you know, a lot of these stories that we tell are data driven or science driven. And we want to show scientific process. We want to show how scientists do their work as well, which is, again, another way of helping open people's eyes to the way discoveries are made and how those discoveries can then have a huge impact on our world.
Yeah, and it's always easier to kind of be taught when you're being taught in an entertaining way, I think, for kids and adults, is when you make it interesting, you tell a great story, you engage people, and then they want to learn, versus making it dry as toast. It's harder to engage the audience, certainly to broaden the audience. So you're listening to A Climate Change. This is Matt Mattern, and I've got Jared Lipworth, head of Tangle Bank Studios, on the program, and we'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to A Climate Change. This is Matt Mattern, and I've got Jared Lipworth, head of Tangle Bank Studios, on the program. And Jared, you know, we were just talking about the power of storytelling to engage people and draw people in to educate them about issues and science. And tell us how Tangle Bank Studios is doing that and approaching that in the work that you're up to.
Yeah, I think it's always about being character driven. Nobody at the end of a long day of work or school or anything else is going to sit down, or very few people are going to sit down wanting to be educated, particularly when it comes to documentaries, when it comes to science and nature. What they are really excited about and get excited about is being told a good story. So if you can find that approach, if you can ground your story in good characters that the audience can identify with, that's when you can get a lot of information in there. And I think, you know, one of our most recent films is an IMAX film called Blue Whales, Return of the Giants, that's currently making its way around science centers around the world. And I think that was a great example. That was a story about blue whales. There's a lot of information in it. But the film followed two different expeditions, one in the Seychelles, where they were trying to find blue whales for the first time in 50 years, because all the blue whales in that area had been wiped out by whaling. And then a separate expedition in the Gulf of California, where a scientist named Diane Gendron had been studying blue whales there every single year for 30 years. And the whales come in at a certain time of year, and she's gotten to know individuals. She can identify more than, I think her database is over 800 whales that she can identify by sight. And the juxtaposition of those two stories worked out really well, because one was exploratory and we didn't know, it was science as it happens out in the field. We didn't know if they were going to find these whales. We didn't know if they were going to be able to tag the whales if they did find them. But this was something that if they did find them, it would change our understanding of the recovery of the whales. You juxtapose that with Diane and her work, where she knows she's going to see the whales. Her approach is a very different type of field work. She is out there studying the whales day after day after day, spending hours and hours observing them. And it's just another way that science happens in the field. So to be able to show that process, to be able to show people who've dedicated their lives to understanding these species in a new way, to me, then sets the stage for being able to provide a lot of great information about the whale, about the whales, about the way science works and all that. So again, it comes down to the good story. You've got great images that people haven't seen before, and you find a way to connect it to them, even if it's something as exotic as the blue whale that most people will never be fortunate enough to see in real life.
Well, I happen to have a blue whale story, and it was going from, L.A. to Catalina Island. I was taking a helicopter ride over there, and there was a mother and baby blue whale in the channel there. And the helicopter pilot said, "Oh, my God, you know, I've flown this route like 5,000 times, and I've seen this maybe five times." And so we kind of circled around it, and it was pretty spectacular to see.
Well, my director was not very happy with me because he was out there for, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks. He's been out there multiple times over multiple years. And then I came down for like 3 days, and we saw everything in those 3 days. And on one hand, they thought I was a good luck charm. On the other hand, they were not thrilled that I made it. I thought it was all very easy because everything's right there. So, right. Yeah, you get lucky sometimes. We were also, you know, part of the story in the film was trying to find a mom and calf, because Diane, the scientist, hadn't seen one in a couple of years. And so that became one of the search points for the film as well. But they're amazing creatures. One of the things we wrestled with early, you know, throughout the whole making of the film was how do you really get people to understand how big these animals are? And I've now been lucky enough to see them in the wild. I still don't really have a handle on it. When you see them in the water, unless there's something next to them to give that perspective. So we wrestled with a lot of different ways within the film as to how we describe it, what you compare it to. We also did, we created an AR app that lets you play around with the size and actually see a blue whale in your own environment, life size, so that people have that that understanding. And then we did a lot of outreach around the films, and we worked with libraries around the country and with science centers. And one of the things we created was a life-size blue whale tail that rolls out like a floor mat. And basically we give it to the libraries. They can lay it out there on the floor. The kids can see how many people can fit on a blue whale tail. And it was just a way, you know, finding those ways to really connect with people and, you know, get beyond the, wow, that's big, to, wow, that now I understand how big that creature actually is. So it's fun to get creative, both within the film and then in the outreach that we do, which is an important part of our mission, to find those connection points.
Yeah, well, a shout out to the California Science Center, which is playing your Blue Whales movie. Is it doing it at IMAX there? They have a big screen, I think.
Yeah, they were a partner of ours in the development of the film, which also had funding from the National Science Foundation. So we actually premiered the film there, and it is still showing there on their 3D IMAX screen. And they created some amazing materials around it as well that they use with the school groups that are coming through who see the film and then want to dive in a little deeper. In fact, I got back late last night. We're down in Laredo, Mexico, which is where we were based when we were filming in the Gulf of California. They have a blue whale festival. So we were screening the film for the local community. We had, over the course of 4 days, about 800 kids from all the local schools who came in for private screenings of the film and a discussion with the scientists. And then California Science Center had set up some amazing activities for the kids to kind of get hands-on. So one of them was trying to understand how the blue whale feeds, this filter feeding, and the kids were on a skateboard, basically going into a mini ball pit, trying to scoop up balls as they went by, kind of illustrating how the blue whale goes after krill. There was another activity they did where the kids were shown sound waves of the whale's noises and had to try to figure out what they thought the whales would sound like. And then they got to listen to the actual sounds of the whales. So there's lots of ways to really get the kids to engage and start to understand the way the whale, you know, why the whale is the way it is in different ways. So it was a lot of fun and great for the local community to see this amazing resource that's right off of their coast and to sort of feel proud of that ownership of that story, which is really their story.
Yeah, I mean, we are very blessed here in Southern California. There is a point out on Palos Verdes where they, you were talking about people volunteering or studying the whales, where they will chart hundreds of different whales that pass that point, migrating both north and south, and all different types of whales that they'll be out there with binoculars and long telephoto lenses and all that stuff to document the migration of the whales.
Yeah, I learned on when I was out there with Diane, I learned that it's not actually, at least for blue whales, it's not very difficult to get a photo that can be used for identification. There's certain things they look at. They look at the dorsal fin. They look at the patterning on the back of the whale. And so you can start to see if there's a way to aggregate all the photos that the tourists take, you can start to see that a whale that shows up off the coast of LA may also be, you know, the next year or later on that year, maybe down in the Gulf of California. And they do that with tags that the scientists are putting on some whales, but you start to get a picture of where these whales are going, which areas need to be protected, where they're most at risk from shipping. So there's a lot you can do, and you know, community science is a big part of what we're trying to get people to engage with. Find a way in your local community to be a part of the conversation, to be a part of the scientific research.
Right. So did you go film down in Magdalena Bay in the where they do the calving down there, I guess? Or
we didn't for this film. We were just in the Laredo area for the Gulf of California part of it, and then off the coast of the Seychelles. So there was plenty between those two locations for us.
Well, I mean, just from the standpoint of getting to see the most amazing places in the world, the Seychelles and the Gulf of California, your job sounds pretty good. You know, I don't know. Maybe I can sign up for that. Where are you off to next?
I always joke that as a kid, I always wanted to be the guy who goes out and spends 18 years studying lions. Then I decided later on, I wanted to be the guy who goes out and spends 6 months filming the guy who's out there for 18 years. And then eventually I landed on, I mostly stay home and send other people out to very cool places. So once in a while I get to go on location, but for the most part, we've got amazing crews who are, love to be out there to bring those places to life. I don't think I would have done very well 21 days on a boat in the Seychelles. I'm not sure that would have been beautiful, but wouldn't have been great. I get seasick too easily.
I hear you. I'm a similar landlubber. The Dramamine would run out at some point in time, and I have to deal with it myself. So, what other projects are you working on over at Tangle Bank Studios right now?
Well, the other big one is that series Wild Hope that I mentioned. So we're on our second season of that. The first season we had 8 half hours, and they're all on YouTube and they're all available for free. We partnered globally for free. We partnered with PBS Nature, so the films are actually going out on their YouTube channel. That's a big push. What we're really trying to do there is use these films to start a movement where we're telling stories about conservation successes, but really we're trying to build a community and activate it to get involved where they are. So for example, one of our films from season one was about the Billion Oyster Project in New York City, where, community groups can get involved in bringing oysters back to New York Harbor to clean the harbor.
Well, that's great stuff. You are listening to it here at A Climate Change, and I've got Jared Lipworth, head of Tangle Bank Studios, and we'll be back in just 1 minute to talk to Jared about all the amazing work that he's doing. You're listening to A Climate Change. This is Matt Matter, and I've got Jared Lipworth, head of Tangle Bank Studios, on the program. And Jared, we were talking about whales, and I just happened to have the chance to interview Captain Paul Watson, who was the head of Sea Shepherd, and now has got his own thing and whale wars and all of that. And, he was talking about krill and that they're doing all this krill farming that is kind of going after the food that the whales eat. Is that something that you covered in any of your, documentary on blue whales?
Not specifically krill farming, but certainly in the blue whale film, we look at the recovery of the blue whales. There used to be 300,000 of them around the world, most in Antarctica. Whaling wiped them out. There were scientists back in the 50s and 60s who felt that we had reached that point where they were going to go extinct. There's now somewhere between 15 and 20,000, and they are recovering in places. But part of the concern with them is their food supply. You know, they need to eat a lot. They've grown that big because they need to eat. So it's a cycle of they eat. They're big because they eat a lot. They eat a lot because they're big. And so when their food supply changes, you find some pretty significant differences. That's one of the things Diane, who's been following them in the Gulf of California for 30 years, she starts to see those trends. Or if she's seeing skinny whales, which you can really notice, the worry is their food supply being depleted by global warming, by farming? Who knows? I don't think we know enough yet about them to know what all the causes are. But, different times of years. When I was there filming, it was about this time 2 years ago. And there were blue whales. Literally, there was one day where in every direction we looked, we were seeing whales. Now, same time of year, the blue whales have already left that area. The blue whales go where the food is, so it means that the food has changed this year to last year. Now, that's not a trend necessarily, but that's what the scientists are trying to understand, is sort of where is the food supply? Is the food supply changing on a yearly pattern, or are there bigger trends at play here? But very much plays a role and will play a role in the survival of the species.
Yeah, one of the things that Captain Paul had talked about was just the amount of poop that the blue whales have, and it kind of fertilizes the ocean. And that if we don't have animals like that out there, it causes a circle effect of damaging the entire ecosystem.
That's exactly right. And we do talk quite a bit about that in the film. There's something called a whale pump. So the whales tend to eat deep and poop shallow. So they're basically bringing up the nutrients from the deep waters back up to the top where, and that leads to, when there's enough of them there doing that, it significantly transforms a place and, it makes the ocean healthy. And then you get these hot spots of life where there's so much other life that is coming in because their poop then leads to phytoplankton, and phytoplankton starts to feed other species, and then other species come in to feed on those. So you get these incredible upwellings of nutrients, and you get these incredible hot spots of all different kinds of marine life when you have whales in the ecosystem. So when you see a whale poop on the giant screen, it's a lot. And then you imagine that when there were 300,000 of them, and that's just blue whales, how they actually can have a significant impact on the ocean. And the kids all get a kick out of the poop for sure. No question about that.
Well, the full circle here, the phytoplankton is responsible for the creation of oxygen, I think, for all of us, I think it's the creation of oxygen, right?
Through photosynthesis. Here. Yeah. I mean, certainly involved in that. Yeah.
Right. So if we have more whale poop, we're going to have more oxygen. Like the whole cycle is there, that if the global warming kind of is affecting, too much CO2 in the atmosphere, this is kind of the antidote to that. And if we kill off all the phytoplankton, we're not going to survive. We're dead as a species.
Yeah, and I think there's so much we understand about that on a global scale, also so much we don't. I think what we often do in our shows, we're trying to illustrate that at a smaller level. So, we're looking at specific ecosystems. The whales are across the whole ocean, but their story is one piece of that. We did another film a couple of years ago that I think was one of those ones that gave a lot of information in a pretty cool way. It was about the reintroduction of wild dogs to a national park in Mozambique called Gorongosa National Park. And on one hand, they were bringing these wild dogs back because wild dogs are very rare and threatened and need, their territory has just been constricting. So here was a place that used to have them. And they wanted to bring the wild dogs back because that could be a safe place to, for them to live. But on the other side of that equation, the ecosystem was missing the wild dogs, really needed them, because there were certain prey species that were kind of outside of their lanes. They were eating in places where they shouldn't be eating because they had no threat. So they were out on the plains when they should be in the bushes. You bring the wild dogs in, their behavior changes. So when you bring a predator into an ecosystem, it's not just about how many prey they eat. In fact, that's not really where the main impact lies. It's what they call the landscape of fear. You're creating behavior change. The predators are creating behavior change in the prey, which helps balance out the way the ecosystem should work when it's working normally. So, you know, again, I think to be able to explore that through the reintroduction of an endangered species was, in my mind, a great way to tell a story, get to see some incredible animal behavior, some incredible work by scientists and conservationists, and learn a lot about how ecosystems work.
So where would we see that particular episode?
So that film was called Nature's Fear Factor, and it was a Nova, a PBS Nova. So it's actually streaming for free from the PBS site, and is available, at least in the U.S., should be available for free online.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I remember seeing a video that was shot about the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone and how it changed the course of the river. And it, if anybody was kind of wary about reintroducing wolves into the wild, you see that and you think, well, it makes total sense. And without the wolves in the environment, the deer run wild and it causes havoc. So
yeah. And one of the things that the scientists have often told me, and I think I take to heart and try to make sure that we're conveying in our films, is that quite often you think you're trying to restore a place to a balance it once had. And that's not really the way scientists think of it. It's not about a balance that there once was, because it's always evolving. What you're trying to do is put a place back into some kind of equilibrium that works in the present. And sometimes that requires a lot of involvement from us, because the ecosystems are so degraded for many reasons that they need our involvement. Other times, and in many cases, we find that if you give nature a chance, it comes back. So if you set the stage and you get out of the way, it's pretty remarkable how quickly it can recover.
Well, I'd like you to kind of circle back to your show, Wild Hope, and one of the concepts that you talked about earlier, which I thought was fascinating, was kind of the intimacy that you're trying to create in as part of this process. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure, absolutely. Both within the shows themselves and in the movement that we're trying to create, it's about finding connection points and helping the viewers find ways that they can get involved. So I mentioned the Billion Oyster Project before in New York City, and that's a great example of how this show is talking. There are scientists who are involved, there are citizens who are involved, there are teachers and students who are involved, there are volunteer organizations who are involved, and there's so many different ways to be a part of that program. Some of our others are much more exotic and other locations that don't necessarily relate to a viewer who's watching it in California or in New York or anywhere else. But what we try to do around the films is to showcase ways that people can get involved. And in some ways, we're still early. We're in our second season. We're trying to throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall to see what kinds of engagement people get excited about. So we did an episode about saving the axolotl in Mexico City. It's this amazing little creature that a lot of people know from pet stores and from scientific research, but there's very few of them left in the wild in this one location. So a call to action from that: you can actually donate money to the research that's being done. You can pay for an axolotl's dinner or its house or its habitat. Another example, we have a film about the reintroduction of beavers to the UK. And in that, one of the calls to action for that film is you can actually work with NASA to help identify beaver dam locations using satellite images from NASA. So I don't know. I mean, I thought that was really cool. How fun to sit at your desk and, you know, try to find beaver dams. So there's lots of ways to do that. Where, you know, other ways, get involved in your local community. We do a lot of work with iNaturalist and the app Seek and BioBlitzes, because BioBlitz is a great way to get outside wherever you are and to start to explore your ecosystem, understand what's there, understand how the species interact with each other. So the idea is really to wherever you are, there's something you can do. And maybe that starts with sharing. You know, share our films with your friends. That's one very small engagement point. But from there, we hope that it's going to build and people can find ways to do a whole lot more and become part of the solution and feel like they can be actually making a difference.
Well, I know that I had read about the Billion Oyster Project when I was planning to go back to New York for the 1% for the Planet conference, which is, something like 5,800 different nonprofits are sponsored by 1% for the Planet. And one of the activities they had was to go out and kind of replant, I guess, I don't know what the word for it is, oysters out there, which help, I guess, filter the water there in New York and kind of restore the ecosystem to some degree of balance. So amazing work that you're doing. We'll be back in just 1 minute to talk to Jared more. Stay tuned. You're listening to A Climate Change. This is Matt Matter, and I've got Jared Lipworth, head of Tangle Bank Studios, on the program today. And, it's been a pleasure talking with you. And just kind of circling back to the oyster project that we were talking about in New York, and I know you cover it in your film. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, it's circling back to that, and also to what we were talking about earlier about storytelling. You know, I always think in these films, if in a film, a 1 hour or a half hour film, there's probably at most two or three things that people are going to remember. And so when we're making these films, we always try to think about what are the takeaways we want them to remember, and how are we going to make sure they do. And I think the Billion Oyster Project was a great example. People have this vague idea. Some people have this vague idea that oysters can clean the water, but we wanted to really be able to show that. So one of the scenes in the film, we've set up two fish tanks, both with very dirty water from the river. One had oysters in it, one didn't. And then we set up a clock and we ran a time lapse. And over the course of 8 hours, you see the tank with the oysters in it go from completely murky water to completely clear, and the other one stays dirty. And I were watching this, and we had this idea early on that if people forget everything else about the film, they'll probably remember that little scene and understand something more about oysters than they ever did before. And so, you know, I think those are the kinds of anecdotes and kinds of visual stories that we like to find to help people remember the key points that we want them to take away from the films.
Well, it's fascinating that we could clean up an area around New York City, which we, I think of as such a densely populated place that it could never kind of be au naturel again, and to bring it back to a cleaner, environmentally balanced place is kind of an amazing project.
Yeah. And, I think it's not going to be the oysters alone that clean up the waters in New York, but they can certainly have a pretty significant impact and start to point the way to how do we clean it up completely.
Right. It's taking that first step or taking a step, and we continue to take good steps, then we'll get better results. And I think lots of people in this environmental movement recognize that if people feel that they are never going to make a difference, they won't act. If they feel like, hey, we're doomed, why even try? Versus we need to be inspired to see humans can make a huge mess, but we also can clean our mess up.
Yeah. And we, you know, we try to find those bigger themes as well, to illustrate that on both on a small intimate level, but also globally. Two of our films from Wild Hope deal with rights of nature and the efforts to get rights of nature written into the laws and the constitutions of countries. So our first season, we had a film called Does Nature Have Rights, which looked at Ecuador and how they were actually the first country to write the rights of nature into the constitution, and how now conservationists are using that as a tool to try to save rainforests and endemic species. And then in season two, we've got another episode in Panama where they're using that same idea to protect marine ecosystems and turtles and other endangered species. So, you know, this is an idea, this is a global idea. It's starting to catch on in a lot of different countries around the world, where you're looking at nature differently, and we're looking at them not as a resource to be utilized and depleted, but as entities that have rights on their own. So I think that's one of those bigger themes that we try to tackle and that we expect we'll be coming back to more than once over the next few seasons, because it's a growing movement and we want to showcase where that's happening.
Well, you know, it's a bit embarrassing and humbling that as a lawyer for 30 plus years, I didn't know about the rights of nature until like the last year or two, and had a guest on the program and we're talking about the rights of nature, because it wasn't something that we learned in law school. It wasn't a concept that was out there. And we think of corporations have rights, and they're no more than a piece of paper. Yeah. And ships actually have rights. That was one of the things that one of the guests were talking about. Ships have rights, but a river doesn't have rights, or an ocean doesn't have rights, or a lake doesn't have rights. That's kind of crazy that we should treat those things with as much care as we treat anything else, because we're so dependent upon it. For God's sake, like anybody who lives out here in the West, we recognize that our water is if we screw it up, we're toast. We're out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing to see how it's catching on as well. Cause I'd never heard of it either until a couple of years ago, but it starts small and then more countries are now seeing it and seeing that, that opportunity. And you know, I think a lot of the key is to figure out how to do it in a way that works for the local communities as well. I mean, the key to the conservation ultimately comes down to if you're telling people not to do something that is part of their livelihood, you also have to figure out, they have to figure out ways to change their livelihoods that benefit both themselves and the conservation of the ecosystems and species around them. And we've got a lot of examples within the film of exactly that, places where it's a different way of thinking, a different way of approaching conservation. So it's not about the fortress model where you're keeping people out. It's about helping people understand that there are ways to benefit where there's mutual benefit to both wildlife and people. And I think that's the key to conservation, I think, in this era, is to find more and more ways to do that.
Let's talk a little inside baseball for a minute here and say, you know, how do you go about doing this and supporting maybe documentary filmmakers or people who are out there doing this type of work? Are you engaged in that type of, you know, finding people who are great directors who have great stories to tell? How do you go about finding that?
We do. It's a really big part of our mission as well. You know, not only are we out there telling these stories, but we're also helping to train a more diverse body of filmmakers, people from different backgrounds outside of natural history and science programming, people from all over the world. The idea, I believe, that having local people tell their stories, you're going to get different perspective than if you fly in and tell someone else's story. So we work with the Jackson Wild Summit and Media Labs to train up and coming filmmakers or people who have been working in other parts of our world. You know, maybe it's photographers, maybe it's scientists. Teach them to become better science communicators and filmmakers so that we can actually start getting more of that perspective. We work with an organization in South Africa called NOOF that is building a Pan-African group of incredible filmmakers who are telling the stories of Africa from their perspective. So the more we can do that, the more through our Wild Hope series that we can engage with filmmakers in Brazil, in Panama, wherever we're going, wherever we find these great stories, and they really are all over the world, we find out, we try to find who can tell these stories from a local perspective. How can we help lift the community of filmmakers to make better content, more scientifically accurate content, and bring local perspectives to that storytelling?
Well, that's great. You know, I think of all the indigenous communities and the wisdom that they have that can be imparted to all of us. And what are you doing on that front as far as engaging with indigenous communities to tell their stories?
Yeah, also same thing. Also through Wild Hope, we had an episode in our first season about the Elwha River and the local tribes' efforts to undam the river, which eventually happened. What was great about that film is it's something we were filming for quite a long time. So there was amazing baseline data of what the ecosystem looked like before the dams came down, and then watching the recovery over 10 years. We have another film in Montana about the reintroduction of black-footed ferrets, which also has a great, you know, the indigenous tribes there are very much a part of that effort. What I love is when they start to pair up with scientists who come in from the outside and they're working together to truly understand these ecosystems in new ways and to protect them.
Well, I think that their philosophy, the indigenous groups of, you know, looking seven generations out or longer of what our effect is going to be, we need to start doing kind of longer term planning and saying, hey, how is this going to affect people downstream? Like, unfortunately, our myopic view of life, it driven by our capitalistic system, which is one quarter's profits or the next quarter and the next fiscal year, is just too short term to really make good decisions, unfortunately. How are we going to change that?
Start to show people that there are people doing it. I mean, I think honestly, that's the thing. It's like, how do you relate? How do you show, how do you help an audience understand that they can make a difference? You know, we realized midway through our first season of Wild Hope, we realized that five of our episodes completely unintentionally had farmers at the hearts of their stories. And when you think about it, it makes a whole lot of sense. Farmers are very close to the land. They're a part of, you know, they're part of some of the problems. They're also a part of many of the solutions. And so when you start to, you know, to see that, it's about creating that, that on-ramp where you're moving in the right direction. You're not being short-sighted. You're looking at what the long-term viability of your projects are, and you know, as you say, let's not just stop it next week. Let's stop it next generation and seven generations down the line.
Jared, thanks for being on the program. Jared Lipworth, of head of Tangle Bank Studios. It's been great talking with you about these issues, and I applaud the great work that you're doing out there in the community. Check out Wild Hope. Check us out at aclimatechange.com. You can check us out at Apple, Spotify, iHeart. Thank you for tuning in, and tune in next week. We're going to have other great guests coming up. We can change the world.